Often when we think of trying to discern God's will or figure out what God wants from us, we feel like people from the first part of our gospel. Blind people wandering around in this big dark chasm trying to figure out what to do. And as we're in this big room bumping into each other and wandering around, we're trying to hope something sticks. We either hit something or we find a trail or we find some sort of path that leads us to God's will. But largely it feels like a goal without an aim. And yet, this is where I want to focus. Because the church in her wisdom has an exceptional amount of wealth in discerning God's will. I argue we have more weight behind our principles and clearer principles than any other religion in the world. Like by far any other religion in the world. And I want to present those to you today, that you may see the wisdom of the church in figuring out God's will and how to find it for yourself. Now the first principle, which is not a surprise and not the one we like, is patience. The church in her wisdom has 2,000 years of history. We have learned we can wait things out. It's going to be okay. And the same thing works for us too. Waiting on things reminds us that God's will does not change. It's always going to be the same. And he's going to keep telling us again and again and again because he wants us to know his will. So if we miss it the first time or ignore it the first time, not a big deal. He will tell us again. And he'll tell us again. And then we'll see the pattern, and it'll make sense. So the church has found out that if we just wait things out, they work themselves out. God makes things work out in the end. The second one is very close to it. By waiting for things, we notice something. We see fruits, which is the second part of our gospel for today. If we wait things out, good fruits are produced, and we can see what is true from what kinds of fruits come from events or actions or people. Which this idea actually summarizes all the last 3 weeks of gospel passages, making them into this nice little package for us. If we go back 2 weeks, we have the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes taught us that true happiness comes when we let ourselves be open to the mystery of God. When we let all the cares and concerns of the world around us ebb away for a little bit, that we focus on different things. We focus on things that open us up to the will of God, open us up to his Spirit. Similarly, the week after that, last week, we saw similar events of that. That by condemning and judging and forcing our evil thoughts on people, that does not leave us a place for God. Instead, we must love one another. And love is the fruit of the Spirit. That truly loving each other, loving our enemies, loving the people around us, is a gift that opens us up to realize God's at the helm of everything. He's going to take care of stuff. What reason do I have to do on any of this stuff? Leading up to today, fruits. Now, largely, we think of fruits in a kind of personal perspective. And this is where things get challenging. On one level, when we comply with the will of God and we're open to his will, we see the fruits of the Spirit. Gentleness, kindness, patience, endurance, chastity, self-control. All these different gifts flower out of our lives and give us that impetus, that realization that God is with us. He is actually helping me. This is his will. But sometimes we don't feel it. We don't recognize it. And that's okay, because they can also be felt in the external. People realize our kindness, our gentleness. They see the love that pours out of us. They see us growing in holiness, even though we don't. And that's also a sign of fruit of God's action in our lives. So we have to look for fruits. What happened? What is God doing? He always produces an abundance, and it's always good fruits. So we never have to worry. We just have to watch. The third one is very important, and it's one that we don't realize how great this really is. With 2,000 years of history, that means we have billions of people who have written about God, what he has done, what he can do, what they've experienced, that we have such a wealth of information. Largely, we should be able to find someone or something that relates to what we're experiencing. There's nothing new under the sun, as Ecclesiastes tells us. So somebody has dealt with the same situation once before. So we can compare it. Who were they? Ah, that was a great saint who felt like that. Oh, that was a heretic who got burned. Maybe I shouldn't do that one. But we have this entire tradition, all these people that guide us to see how God acts, what he does, and to compare our lives to it, that we may have something else to balance it out with. These principles are fun and exciting, but they really don't do much until I put them into practice. So let me give you some examples of what I mean to show you how the church put these into practice and that we may put them into practice in our own lives. As I was pondering this homily and trying to figure out how to give you good examples, I was really hoping for the lives of the saints. The reality is, most of the time, lives of the saints are second or third hand. We don't get into their mind. We don't get to see what they wrestle with. We don't get to see what challenges they had. Instead, we see someone writing about them. There is one exception, and this is St. Thérèse of Lisieux, or Thérèse of the Child Jesus. She wrote us an autobiography. She wandered in the midst of all this stuff and gave us an inkling into her mind, even though I think she dismissed quite a bit of stuff. Nevertheless, the last 4 years of her life were wrought by immense suffering. She had tuberculosis, and it eventually killed her. These last 4 years were so immense in her suffering, she said she felt like she ate at the table of atheists. She was so wrought by it. She was so racked by the suffering she experienced. She understood the arguments of the atheists. Here is a woman who is one of the greatest saints of the 20th century. She shows us that even in the midst of great suffering or thoughts roaming around our head that are not good, she can stay firm in her faith, steadfast in the midst of all that. She's an example of what I mean. Here are some better ones. St. Juan Diego. We're now in the 1500s. We're in Mexico. St. Juan Diego was walking around one day, and he walked past this hill, Tepeyac. Our Lady appeared to him. She said, "I want you to build a chapel here." So he went to the bishop and said, "Our Lady appeared to me. She said, build a chapel over there." He said, "I don't believe you." Which is how we should respond. We can't agree with every person that comes up to us and said, "I had a mystical experience." So he was smart about it. "Show me a sign. Make it clear to me. If this is God's will, he will ratify it. He will make it clear to us that this is his will." So Juan Diego went back and asked her for a sign. He looked down and there's a bunch of Castilian roses that had grown on the hill. Now here's the strange part. Roses don't grow in the winter. Castilian roses don't grow in Mexico. So there's two parts of this that don't make sense. How could they be there? He thought this was the great sign. Here are some roses in the dead of winter. So he bundled a bunch of them up, put them in his outer cloak, and went to the bishop and said, "Here is your sign." The bishop said, "I don't think so. I don't believe you." So, disappointed, he let go of his garment and all the roses fell to the ground, and what was left behind on his telma afterwards was the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe, an image that combined Mayan mythology and Catholic mythology together into one, showing the connection between Our Lady and as Mother of the Americas. That image did it. That was all that was needed for him to be convinced. Because you can't just paint that. It's a pretty spectacular image, and he realized that right away. Again, patience, waiting for the right sign, recognizing the signs, what are we looking for, and knowing the tradition enough to say, here's clearly something divine. Next one. Now we turn to France, 19th century France. In 1854, Pope Pius IX declared Mary the Immaculate Conception. This was not received well, believe it or not. Theologians have been wrestling with this concept for over 300 years and really largely didn't know what to do. A great group of them said, no, she cannot be. The only true Immaculate Conception is the Holy Spirit. Anything else makes her divine, not human. And so they wrestled and debated and it got kind of ugly until Pope Pius IX declared it dogmatically. She is the Immaculate Conception. Let's fast forward 4 years. We're now in 1858. Bernadette of Subaru was going out to play with her friends one day, and Mary appeared to her. She was scared, so she decided to pray. Great idea. Prayer always works. She couldn't pray until Our Lady helped her pray. Then she said, "Drink some water." So she went to the stream, and she said, no, not there. Over here. So she had to dig in the ground, and eventually got a little trickle of water. Just enough. Came back the next day, it was a pool. Next day, stream. Next day, a river. Kept growing. She was also told that she was the Immaculate Conception. So Bernadette went back and told her parish priest what had happened. He said, "I don't believe you. How could you know this information?" He got a few more priests, a theologian, and the bishop to come interrogate her, basically, and say, "How do you know this? Do you know what it means? Do you understand what is meant by the Immaculate Conception?" Because they thought she was faking it. Maybe a friend had told her. Maybe she learned it somewhere. This can't be what she was called. After a long inquiry, they realized, no, she had no idea what that meant. Neither do we, consequently. But nevertheless, she had no idea. And then they realized that Mary was ratifying what Pope Pius IX had said. She is the Immaculate Conception. Hence, testing and proof and validation, all in one. Let's move to a new area that's a little more controversial. This one's fun. Medjugorje. A lot of people have found great spiritual merit in Medjugorje. Because they either seen Our Lady or in flowered with fruits, great things have happened. The original seers were great people who have still lived good, holy lives and have shown that there's something wonderful, divine, happening in Medjugorje. But there's a challenge. The second generation, or the people who wanted to be seers, started to proclaim it a little bit more boldly, started doing book tours, started to doing tours around various places and gain some money for themselves. As soon as that happened, the Vatican said, enough, we're putting this on hold. Notice they didn't say no, they said on hold, because there's something good, we just have to wait it out. And that's the essential challenge of Medjugorje. Since the visions are still happening and the seers are still alive, we won't make a declaration. Anything could happen from here. It could go sour really fast, and then we'd have to do something. So the Church in her wisdom knows, wait till the visions end, and once they end, we'll see what happens. Is there good fruits? Is there bad fruits? We'll know immediately what we ought to do. So we're waiting. We're playing the waiting game. And we're also waiting to see what fruits. How do people react? How do we to understand this? Now you see what I mean. But let's make this personal for a moment, because it's all fun and games to see all the wonderful things that have happened through our history, but we are the ones who want to know this, and that's where we're stuck, because knowing God's will is so immensely helpful. We have a sense of purpose, direction. We have something we can do, and so we desire it just as much as the Church does. How do we get there? Well, it's very simple. Let me give you an example. St. Teresa of Avila was told by God that he wanted her to start a new foundation in northern Spain. So she got a little crew, they got all their supplies, they're heading along, and as they're heading towards this location in northern Spain, a huge torrential downpour hit. So they're walking around and they get to a stream, a raging stream. Not possible to cross it. The companion said to her, "Sister, we can't cross this stream, it's not possible." She stopped, thought for a little while, walked upstream and said, "What about here?" Perfectly calm. They walked across the stream. Some of the people with her looked back afterwards and saw it raging again. God provides a way. Same thing works for us. If we realize that patience is a way of understanding God's will and allowing ourselves just to be open to the will of God, open to whatever may happen and living our lives in accordance with that, it'll be okay. When the time is right, he'll show it to us. We should also be watching for what happens in our own lives. What kinds of fruits? Do I feel gentle? Do I feel calm? Do I feel under control? Do I feel like the virtues are flowering in me? What is my reaction? What are other people's reactions to me? Do they avoid me at all costs and run away because I'm a scary individual? That might be a good sign that's not the way it should be. Or do people realize there's something to me? I'm gentle, I'm kind, I have some wisdom, I have some strength to me. What is it that is different in me? And lastly, we do need to know the tradition of the Church. What have the saints said? What is our theology? Does it match with what I'm experiencing, or is it something very strange? Believe it or not, we have had many cases in the Church history where an individual saint or group of seers have solidified or expanded or even shifted some of our theology to just because we were kind of off a little bit. There's been many situations like that. So yes, this is important. Our desire is the will of God. And we desire it because then we get to know Him. Him personally. We get to walk with Him. We get the experience of knowing Him. We get to feel the flowering of this new life in us, the good fruits that bring joy. And we know that God is truly with us.